Being here this morning. Now I want you to look up at the screen as we begin. This rodent is hated or loved every February. One particular year, there was a sheriff in a particular county in the state of Ohio that issued a death warrant for Punxsutawney Phil. Because he had promised an end to winter, and it had not come, and it was particularly severe. And here is the thing, when someone is going through a particularly brutal season and you tell them it's going to get better in the future, you need to be right. So Revelation is written to people in a hard season. Because when you live under the thumb of a brutal empire that demands worship that you can only legitimately give to Jesus, then you find yourself in a very tough place. And we have seen, as we have worked through Revelation, that this pressure is coming from three different sources that Jesus has identified in his vision that he's given to John to give to the churches. And the most obvious source is Rome and the empire that is demanding allegiance. But we find out that behind that is another, the beast, who is actually working for the dragon, or Satan. And what John is going to do is he's going to deal with each of these three enemies one at a time. And we're going to look at chapters 17 and 18 today, and he's going to deal with Babylon. In chapter 19, we will look at the beast. And then finally in chapter 20, we will deal with the dragon. Now, this is a common literary device known as recapitulation. This is John telling the same event from different angles. Many people look at the book of Revelation as a chronological timeline, as a sequence of events. I believe that is the wrong approach to this book. John has been telling us that God is going to judge evil. He will end all of it. He will start with Babylon when he begins. Now, you'd think that he would give most of the attention to the beast or to the dragon, but actually he gives most of his attention to Babylon, because that's what's felt every single day. That's the pressure that was very real, that could be seen with the eyes. And if you're in a hard season, then you are actually going to be warmed by a cold forecast for Sin City. So we've got a lot to do today, so let's get started. Chapter 17 of Revelation. Open up your Bibles. Follow along with me, please. We're going to begin in the first verse. John, the Revelator, writes these words. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. And please notice in that text the description of the opulence, of the affluence of this woman. And we see Jesus giving this vision to John to be a blessing to the church. And he's using these pictures, these metaphors all through. And the metaphor that he chooses for Babylon is a prostitute. You see, we tend to talk about sin as a location. Well, here's God, and over here is sin, and your sin has separated you from God, and there's this big gulf in between. But in the Bible tends to talk about sin not in terms of a location, but more of a relationship. You see, sin at its heart is a betrayal of a person. And the most common word used to illustrate this in Scripture is adultery. Now, I don't typically go for name calling, but I think it's okay if Jesus does it. And this woman who presents herself as a queen, Jesus calls a whore. Sin, filling up in pride and luxury. And she's on the prowl. She is drunk on the blood of the saints. Now, that's not just talking about the martyrs, by the way. The context is going to make it very clear that he's talking about all of the Christians who were seduced into their destruction because they got attracted to this prostitute. So, who is the prostitute? Well, Revelation 17, verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. Now, everybody in antiquity knew that Rome was built on seven hills. But verse 18 that was read at the very beginning of worship makes it even more clear for us. Verse 18, the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. So he's calling Rome a whore. Why? Why did he choose that image? The metaphor implies Rome is offering something that men lust for, that men think they want. You see, her allure is conceited. Jesus is admitting that Babylon has something that you think you want. And it also implies that what Sin City offers is a counterfeit. See, a prostitute is not offering you loyalty or covenant or love. She's offering a cheap imitation of those things. So, what is Rome offering that men want so much of that has the whole world under her spell? Rome seduced the world with the offer of wealth. Look at Revelation chapter 18, verse 3. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. Rome said to the world, "Get in bed with us, and you will prosper." And that is so seductive. Mark Twain once said, "Some men worship rank, some worship heroes, some worship power. Some worship God, and over these ideals they dispute and cannot unite, but they all worship money." Rome sold herself to the world as the provider of economic security. And getting in bed with her seemed like a very winning strategy. When you read those letters to the seven churches, it is very, very obvious they were feeling significant financial pressure. You're a tradesman. You have a family that you need to support. You need suppliers. You need a place that you can sell your goods. But that guild that you have to join to be able to sell in the marketplace worships the prostitute. So you have a hard decision. You have a family to care for, and you have a prostitute to satisfy. Are you going to hook up with the hooker? Here's the deal. It's why Jesus chooses this metaphor. It is never wise to invest your future with a prostitute. You might get a temporary fake imitation of the real thing, but do not kid yourself. There is no future with a prostitute. Look at chapter 18, beginning in the first verse. John says, "After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, 'Fallen! Fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart, she boasts, "I sit as queen. I'm not a widow, and I will never mourn. Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her. Death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her." Notice, he keeps saying, give back to her what she has given. Here's the thing. The prostitute doesn't love you. She pretends she does. But she just wants to exploit you. You see, her values are perverted. In fact, it's a two-way relationship of manipulation. The prostitute and the client just want to use each other. And they say, "We're not hurting anybody. We're just two consenting adults." But people, innocent people, always get hurt by this kind of business. And I'm going to show you that. Look at chapter 18, verse 9, where John continues. "When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, 'Woe! Woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power! In 1 hour, your doom has come.' The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore." Are the merchants weeping because they love her? No. They're weeping because they can't sell their cargoes with her anymore. And pay very close attention to the next few words, what the cargo actually is. It's critical. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood, and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh, and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and bodies and souls of men. How do empires get rich? Slavery. Real or economic? Slavery. They're not mourning the presence of suffering when Babylon falls. They're mourning the absence of a system that made them rich at the expense of other people. Babylon is judged just like Egypt, just like all the other empires. She became powerful on the backs of the poor and the marginalized who had to make bricks to build their empire. The spirit of Babylon is that materialistic bent to gain wealth at the expense of others. This is how all Babylons operate throughout history. And God hates that. He hates it. He judges it. You remember Sodom and Gomorrah? It wasn't just their immorality that brought God's judgment on them. Look what the prophet Ezekiel says in Ezekiel 16, verse 49, speaking of Sodom. "She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. You see, we think as Christians that the most horrible thing that could happen to the church is persecution. Actually, the most horrible thing that can happen to the church is accumulation. It destroys empires nationally, and it destroys people personally. Look what James says in James chapter 5, beginning in the third verse. The brother of Jesus writes, "Your gold and silver have become worthless. The very wealth you were counting on will eat away your flesh like fire. This treasure you have accumulated will stand as evidence against you on the day of judgment." Why is that? Well, he continues, "For listen, hear the cries of the field workers whom you've cheated of their pay. The wages you held back cry out against you. The cries of those who harvest your fields have reached the ears of the Lord of Heaven's armies. You've spent your years in luxury, satisfying your every desire. You have fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter." You think people don't get hurt by prostitution? Innocent people all over the world are marginalized and impoverished by world systems that keep the rich and powerful rich and powerful. The desire for wealth controls the world, and most people are blind to how much it controls them. James asks the question in his letter, why are there quarrels and fights and wars? He said, it's because your desires are evil. You want and you can't have, so you fight. And that explains the world. The world operates on a scarcity mentality. There's only so much, and if I'm going to get mine, I'm going to have to take it from you. Instead of operating on the mentality that God is very generous, that God is very good, God will take care and provide for you and His creation, the world operates on the mentality of, I better get mine now. This is how we operate globally, and oftentimes it's how we operate personally. And every single year we see this played out on Black Friday as fights, tramplings, even deaths occur as the I gotta get mine plays out in stores across America. And so all over the New Testament, the one sin mentioned more than any other sin is greed. Twice in the New Testament, greed is called idolatry. But in 25 years of preaching, I've heard almost every single sin confessed, some I didn't even know existed. Except I have never heard one person confess to me, I'm a greedy person. I've never met a greedy Christian. I've never met a church that thought they were Laodicea. This is because we have a hard time being honest. The revelation of Jesus Christ is not to just help us look into the heavenlies, but it is to help us look right into the core of our hearts. How attracted am I to having a fling with a system that cannot completely satisfy or ultimately endure any more than a relationship with a prostitute? Revelation 18, verse 14. John says, they will say, the fruit you long for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, woe! Woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. You see, her future is decided. And they can't believe it. Because the lie is, if you have a lot of wealth, if you have a lot of things, then you are powerful, you are invincible. Rome cannot fall. America can't be brought down. And that's a lie. Everything the prostitute offers is a lie. Look at verse 17. Every sea captain And all who travel by ship, the sailors, and all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, "Was there ever a city like this great city?" They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, "Woe! Woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she has been brought to ruin." And you keep seeing that phrase, "in 1 hour." That's Jesus' way of saying, you think Babylon is forever, but when I judge, it's going to be over like that. You see, her future is decided. God always brings Babylon down. And he often does it through the agency of the prostitute's own clients. Because the clients don't really love the prostitute. They just want to use her as much as she wants to use them. We have this interesting text in chapter 17. It's very complex, where he talks about the kings and the horns, and scholars can't figure this out chronologically. I would tell you, don't even try. There's no way to line up how many emperors Rome has had with all of the crowns that are mentioned. But the point is, Rome has her emperors, and she has all these people like Herod, who are her clients, and they go to bed together, and they act like they love each other, and then they always turn on each other. See, these relationships never end well. Look at chapter 17, verses 15 through 17. "Then the angel said to me, 'The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. The beast and the 10 horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled.'" In other words, God says, here's how I'm going to work all of this out. I'm going to use the very peoples that the prostitute was going to bed with to bring the prostitute down, because evil always implodes on itself. Relationships that are built on manipulation eventually die from the very cancer they were spreading. In John's day, it was inconceivable that Rome will ever not exist. If you're a Christian trying to support your family and you're under the power of Rome, it looks like there's no way that Rome can't win. That's the great illusion. We've already seen that Satan knows he's doomed. He's been kicked out of heaven. He knows that his time is short. Satan knows that it will not last forever. But Babylon does not. Babylon never sees this coming. Every world empire of every age has a superpower that thought they are going to last forever. And none of them have. None of them will. There's only one kingdom that is eternal. And if your allegiance is in the right place, that can be a very thrilling forecast. Look at Revelation 18, verse 20. "Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you." Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, "With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again." Now, you have heard me say that I believe that the book of Revelation is an intensely practical book. It is not made for making charts, but it is made for helping you every single day to make good choices. Because in John's day and in our day, it is very, very easy to be seduced by the way of this world and not even know that it is happening to you. I grew up in Florida. I spent my share of time on the beach and in the water. Skipped a lot of school to be there. And when you are on the beach, when you're in the water, you have to be mindful of this thing called the undertow. You can be out having a very fun time, and all of a sudden you look up and you are very far off from where you are supposed to be. And you think, how did I get here? And it can be very challenging to try to get back to where you're supposed to be. It can be dangerous even. You say, well, how did I get here? It's because you were distracted and you were not aware of the forces that were working against you, pulling you away from where you're supposed to be. We pay dearly for chasing what is cheap. So I believe that there are verses that are absolutely critical to understanding the entire book of Revelation. And I believe John has been getting the seven churches that he's been writing to, I believe he's been getting them ready for this one verse that we're about to read. It is the crux of the choice that he is calling the church to make. Revelation 18, verse 4, it says this, "Then I heard another voice from heaven say, 'Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues.'" I heard a story of a preacher, had this one cantankerous member, and it didn't matter what he preached on. Every single week he'd shake the preacher's hand, and this guy would say, "Well, you got him good today, preacher, you got him good." One Sunday a big blizzard rolls into town and couldn't even drive to church. The preacher walked to the church building. And this one guy is the only guy who comes. So the preacher aims both barrels and he just preaches hell and fire and damnation. And when he's through, this guy gets up and shakes his hand and says, "Preacher, if they'd been here today, you'd have got them good." And that is how most churches in a superpower listen to a sermon about the danger of wealth and materialism. It's got to be for somebody else. I'm saying that if you don't need this warning, then you need a revelation. So I'm going to give you two important things to do. First is this: choose a city. Revelation is a tale of two cities. It's the tale of Babylon and New Jerusalem. And you can't be neutral and you can't be a citizen of Babylusarum. And some of you, I fear, are building your dream house in what is about to be a ghost town. Recognize the imposter for who she is. The prostitute might give you a temporary thrill. She might deceive you into thinking that this is what you're looking for, but that is a lie. And there is no future with her. One of my favorite films is the movie The Avengers. And it's about this team of superheroes who assemble together to fight a godlike being named Loki, who is wreaking havoc on planet Earth. And in one great scene, this demigod Loki runs into the Incredible Hulk. I want you to watch this clip on the screen. You just saw a snapshot of the book of Revelation. That is what's going to happen to every puny god. Leaving Sin City is choosing the eternal over the external. It's choosing the real over the fake, the truly good life over a fleeting thrill. But here is the thing: when Jesus says, come out of Babylon. He's not saying, I need you to form this little huddle and I want you to live somewhere where you're safe from all of the external influences of the world. See, Babylon is everywhere. He's talking about a spiritual relocation. So here is the final word to you. Use wisdom. John says this calls for a mind with wisdom and spiritual discernment to live in a world, but not of this world. To say, I'm going to be a boat in the water, but I'm not going to let the water be in the boat. It takes wisdom to say, I'm not playing this game by your rules because I've got a different scorecard. What the world offers is counterfeit. So let's stop whining and offer something countercultural instead. It takes wisdom to say, never again will I measure a human being by their net worth to determine their self-worth. It takes wisdom to say, if God has given me so much, it's so that I can bless other people, not so that I can hoard it. It takes wisdom to not be seduced by the wary ways of the prostitute. Glenn Atset and his wife have two kids. They lived in China in the 1940s. They were missionaries when the Communist Revolution took over China, and they were immediately put under house arrest. They did not know if they were going to be arrested or if they were going to be executed. And the soldier said, we will let you leave our country right away. Go home and pack. You can take 200 pounds out of our country with you. So immediately they go home. The argument started. What do we take? What do we leave? He wanted to take his books, his typewriter. She wanted to take family heirlooms that had sentimental value. The kids, of course, wanted to take their toys. So they all compromised. They came up with 200 pounds on the nose. The soldiers show up at the house. Are you ready to leave? Yes. Have you weighed everything? Yes. Did you weigh your children? And suddenly their treasure became trash in the combined 200-pound weight of their children. Wisdom will make you love God and love people. Wisdom will help you disdain a system that gives wealth to some and suffering to most. We need wisdom. And we need this revelation more than we know. As we get ready to sing a song of invitation, the question for you is, where has Sin City tried to lure you away from a Father who loves you? Would you stand up as we get ready to sing together this morning?